from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Amy Wilentz keeps going back to a place that she can't escape, Haiti. She's been going there for over 20 years, reporting about Haiti and writing a highly acclaimed book called The Rainy Season. After the earthquake 3 years ago, she told herself she wouldn't go back. She was in Port-au-Prince 2 weeks later. Her new book is about why that's so, why Haiti has that singular hold on her and so many others, why we seem to need Haiti as much as Haiti needs the rest of the world. And it's a book about a relationship between two countries and two peoples, usually misguided, often dysfunctional, and painfully intimate. Amy Wilentz's letter from Haiti, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. 3 years ago, I went to Haiti to cover the aftermath of the earthquake for the PBS NewsHour. When I had the opportunity to go back a year ago, I jumped. I was going as a volunteer this time, but I still had a kind of repertorial greed, a desire to take in all that elemental beauty and dread that is Haiti. Author Amy Wilentz's new book is about why Haiti has that singular power, why it sticks, and why the outside world, as she puts it, keeps sticking its fingers in the Haiti pie. Why do we come? Why do we keep screwing it up, this beautiful, brutal, singular place? Haiti Wilentz has been writing about Haiti for over 20 years. She's the author of three previous books, including the acclaimed book about Haiti, The Rainy Season. She also writes for The New Yorker and The Nation magazines. Her new book about Haiti is called Farewell, Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti. Good morning.
Hi.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
If you would, begin by telling us the story of what happened to you after the earthquake and your initial feeling that you weren't going to go back.
Well, I had been trying to ease myself out after 20 years of engagement, ease myself out a little bit from Haitian involvement and try to do other things. I had had my family and the kids were growing up, and I just thought, let's have a new project. And I was working on a novel set in California and New Jersey, two of my favorite states. And then the earthquake happened, and I didn't want to go back because I would see everything ruined that I had ever thought about. I would see the destruction of all sorts of Haitian dreams for freedom and democracy, the whole place leveled. And when there's a natural catastrophe, often one place is just like another. And I didn't want to see Haiti, which is quite singular and special, at least to me, rendered just one other victim of disaster. So I didn't want to go back. But then I felt I had to go, but that I owed it to Haiti, that it was my responsibility in a way to be there and see it and chronicle it because I had done so much for so long. So indeed, I did go down. Also, I was worried about people I knew and wanted to make sure they had gotten out. You know, people would answer the phone there after the earthquake. Once cell phone towers were back up again, they'd answer the phone. They would go, "Allô, I'm still alive."
So Haiti is under your skin. I mean, it sticks. And 2 weeks later after the earthquake, you were back in Port-au-Prince. Have you figured out why?
No, not really, but I've thought about it a lot. I think it's because it's very tender and delicate in Haiti. The culture is very beautiful and somewhat French. The art, I have this painting I have brought with me while I'm talking about my book, and it's just this beautiful little painting by no one of flowers. And that's the way Haiti is, but it's also very raw and tough. You go to a cockfight in Haiti, and it's unbelievable what you see and how tough the men are who are watching. So it combines. For me, it's like a distillation of the human pantheon. That's just a panoply of characters, and in a small place where I can really get to know humanity in a very immediate and raw form. I know that all sounds crazy, but that's part of what I feel about Haiti.
And is there something different, do you feel, distinctive about that makes it different than a third world experience in a very challenged and difficult country in Liberia or somewhere else in the developing world? Is Haiti different?
Haiti's at a crossroads. It's at a cultural, historical crossroads and always has been. So it is different from Liberia, although when you say Liberia, that's one of the closest because Liberia, too,
because
has been
too
a victim
a
of these same crossroads. But so Haiti is a place where France, the United States, and Africa all met on common ground. That's weird. There are other places like that, though. Haiti is a place now where the 1700s and the 21st century meet. Contact right away. The plows are not used in some parts of Haiti in farming. They still use just shovels and hoes, yet they're on the cell phone. So that's another thing. It's a place where different time periods meet at the same time. It's a place where different ideas of how an economy could be run met in its earliest days so that the African slaves who came over had an idea of a kind of communal way of making things work that they brought over from their villages, and the French planters had a very different idea of how things should work to make an economy run.
It also has a particular and singular tie to American history. You refer to it at one point as it could be a 51st state. Explain what you mean by that and why our narratives, our histories are so intertwined.
Well, first of all, they just simply are intertwined. So that the Haitian Revolution in 1791 that culminated in independence for the first black republic in the world in 1804 was a direct affront to the slaveholding United States. Haiti wasn't recognized by the U.S. until 2 years after the Civil War had come to a conclusion, and the African Americans in our country were, in effect, liberated. So that's a long and torrid relationship. The United States then messed in Haiti's affairs, has always done so, and in fact occupied Haiti from 1915 to 1934. And that's when Haiti, again, very singular, had the world's first guerrilla movement against an occupying force and effectively, yet once again, knocked the white man out of the country, and the Americans left in 1934. But I would also argue, and I think this is very important, I think that Haiti as a black republic right off our shores is kind of a psychological reminder of all the trauma that race has caused in the United States. And that's one reason we can't keep our hands off them. And I think we have worked with the Haitians, and they're in collusion in the destruction of their own country in many ways, the political class of Haiti. We've worked with the Haitians to make sure that this black republic doesn't function very well. And, you know, this is I'm speaking largely and symbolically, and to make sure that they can't govern themselves and to turn their government into effectively a kleptocratic parasite off the Haitian nation.
That sounds a little conspiratorial. I mean, do you really think it was intentional?
Not at all. Not at all. It's just natural. It's the way the two groups, outsiders and Haitians, have functioned together. And the French do it, too. Everybody does it because, you know, it's like in affirmative action. You want to prove by hiring the worst person who comes that they're not very good at their job.
I want to just pull one quote that gave me some context for the history you're describing that I had not known. This is from a Major Smedley Butler, who was involved. Give us the sort of quick synopsis of who he was. But he was basically in charge of keeping down resistance to American occupation.
Yeah, he was in charge of keeping down resistance to American occupation in many places, not just in Haiti. He went all over the place for the Americans in that era where American capital was really building up and a lot of exploitation was going on of resources in South America and in the Caribbean.
So he said after his doing that work in Haiti in, what, the 1920s? 30s?
Yeah, during the occupation.
He wrote, "I was a racketeer, a gangster for capitalism. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National City bank boys to collect revenues. I helped in the raping of a half a dozen Central American republics. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for sugar interests." On and on. He talks about the various places. But, I mean, how much is America responsible for the fact that Haiti has never developed in a way either democratically or with an economic system that works?
Well, during the occupation, for example, the Americans put presidents in and took presidents out of Haiti, and they put in a series of of presidents who were really not competent. They were basically just rubber stamps for whatever the occupation wanted to do. So they encouraged irresponsibility in government during their 30 years there. Well, not 30, 29 years, 19 years, but many years there. And then after them, and they also encouraged the lighter skin classes to be predominant in Haiti, which they were already because they had the most money, they had the most education. And then when they left, when the Americans finally were kicked out, there was a small window of kind of a bearable era. And then Papa Doc came to power in 1957. And I would say, and I do say, that he is a direct response to the American occupation because he came to power on a black nationalist platform. And not that that was really what he believed, because he was a very duplicitous character, but that spoke to Haitians who had been under American occupation all that time. So it's a kind of complicity that has gone on and on, I think.
And what is that? How does that inform the connection that Americans have to Haiti as far as the responsibility that we have? And how does that, again, also inform a kind of paternalistic approach, which is also something that you write about, the way in which charitable efforts are, well, let's take care of the poor Haitians?
Well, it's very comfortable to think of people as lesser than you or a blank slate when you're coming in to do charitable work. So I think that the racial element that has been present in our dealings with Haiti forever, for purely racial reasons, I mean, it was obvious we were going to have to deal with a black republic. But that has played into it. And now that they're so conveniently poor, we can come in and feel really good about ourselves trying to help them. But one of the problems in that is that if part of the relationship of white Americans to even African Americans in our own country is fear. We fear because we feel that we've been privileged in some way and that they have not. So we fear that we've taken something that they don't have and that they might be angry. And in Haiti, we really feared. In fact, 60% of relief money for Haiti from the U.S. government was for the Defense Department of the United States in order to keep the peace in post-earthquake Haiti, because there was a huge undercurrent of fear that there would be riots and attacks and Haitians would burn down buildings. And of course, they weren't doing that. They were trying to bury their dead.
And it's also one of the counterintuitive things about being in Haiti is, you write about this, I felt this when I was there, a sense of great welcoming, a sense of safety, walking through tent camps or all kinds of places where you think it might not feel safe at all, feeling safe.
Yeah.
Can you describe that, what it is that makes for that odd juxtaposition?
Well, one thing that makes for the welcoming is poverty. So if you see, if you're a Haitian and you're living in a tent camp, and my book sort of closes with an episode of this. I'm running through the tent camp. It's raining. It's nighttime, lightning and thunder. I'm looking for people who don't show up. And finally, I think, oh, well, I'll go to these other people, because my friends hadn't shown up and I had one other bunch of people I knew. And suddenly in the rain, a woman is beckoning to me to come into her tent. And it turns out to be, of course, the person I'm looking for. But poverty is one reason you're welcomed, because when they see a face that looks like my face or a face that looks like your face, Dave, they think, well, this is a person who has something, and maybe this is a person who will give something. It is in almost no cases a violent taking, but more like perhaps out of the generosity of your white person's heart, you will give some money to me. You can see my need. So that's part of what the welcoming is about. Another part is African hospitality. It's a much more welcoming kind of thing than an Anglo society. But I believe that the way that you're exposed when you're poor leads to a friendlier attitude toward the outside world.
And so in some ways, we shouldn't kid ourselves about that. It also reminds me of something that you say that you wind up getting really weary of, which is people like me who go as a reporter or others who wind up inevitably using the word resilient and who talk about the indomitable spirit of the Haitian people, that's putting too find a gloss on what's there.
Well, what I don't like about those two ideas is that the implication is no matter what we sling at them, they'll survive, so big deal, no biggie, you know? But what I really think about them, when you talk about resilience and indomitable spirit, is it's not Haitians, it's humans. And for me, the lesson of Haiti has been this is about humanity, not about like weird Haitians or Fred Voodoo, as I call him in the book. It's about how humans can survive in the worst conditions. And I think that it resonates for me because I'm a Jew and I know what people went through during the Holocaust. And I'm not suggesting that life in Haiti is like a Holocaust, but it's a Holocaust of some kind, not the Holocaust. And I think of people on long marches in China under Mao and how they survived. And that's what Haitians do. They survive in the worst kinds of conditions. And so it's not idiosyncratic Haitian resilience. It's human resilience.
Amy Willance is our guest. Her new book is Farewell, Fred Voodoo, and we'll talk about the meaning of that title in a moment. She's also going to be appearing at the World Affairs Council today at noon. So if you're interested in hearing more from Amy Willance, she'll be at the World Affairs Council in San Francisco, Sutter Street, today at noon. Explain the title.
Well, a lot of people think it's called Farewell, Fred Voodoo because I'm just sick of Haiti. Like, goodbye, I'm over it. But that's not true. In fact, I had to write an outraged note to some reviewer who suggested I was never going back to Haiti again. Like, I'm there tomorrow if I can just scrounge up the funds. So Fred Voodoo is not a real person. Fred Voodoo is what the old retrograde, politically incorrect foreign press used to call the Haitian man in the street. So it's like Joe Sixpack. And the reason I say farewell, Fred Voodoo, is that I want to stop thinking about Haitians in that kind of way. And voodoo to me also is a very fraught word. It's not the real name of the religion Haitians practice, which is vodou. But I wanted to use it in my book, and I use it consistently in my book because it, to me, it conjures up all the ways outsiders have thought about Haiti and superstition and black magic and cannibalism, all of which are very far from the Haitian reality. But that's how we still think of them. It comes from the days of slavery where we had to look at them as different.
And you also write about voodoo as being something that that is intrinsic to Haiti and is a kind of logical, assertive response, that it's not woo-woo-woo sort of stuff. Can you describe what that represents to you?
Well, I will say, you know, there are some outsiders who come down to Haiti and they become voodoo acolytes and they, you know, marry the mystère and they just become part of it. And I just can't do that. It's alien to my nature to be part of any religion, much less a religion that I feel is very, very different from everything I've ever known. But what's incredible about voodoo is how the – instead of, you know – Jesus made real in the wafer and the wine, the flesh and the blood of the Lord, you yourself become God. So you go to your voodoo ceremony after working all day in a field, you know, and you put on your nice clothes and you go to the ceremony and it's late at night and everybody's drinking a little bit of very, very, very strong rum or coffee, both sometimes. And the ceremony begins and suddenly you're Apollo. You know, you're Mars. You are one of the pantheon of the gods. He comes into you and you become him. And it's very much a dramatic thing and it's very empowering. And it's very communitarian. The whole community participates. Everybody's watching. You're gathered in a circle. It's always circular.
On the question of empowering, you have a number of examples in the book that talk about the sort of fundamental mistake that we make often, so often, about help in Haiti. And we'll talk more over the course of the hour about the whole NGO, non-governmental organization phenomenon in Haiti being known as the Republic of NGOs. But before we go to all of that, would you tell the story of the meat market and the rebuilding of the meat market in Haiti? Because to me, it has everything to say about sort of what good intentions that just don't get Haiti.
Well, first, let me say I'm very glad that they rebuilt this market. So this is the Iron Market in Haiti. It's very famous. It's very beautiful. If you ever go to my Facebook page, you can see a picture of it behind me. It's a gorgeous red French colonial structure. There are such structures in Africa, in French West Africa also. So it was built in France, first of all. In the first place, it wasn't Haitian. It was meant for Egypt. So it wasn't even meant for Haiti. Hmm. Then the Egyptians didn't want it or something. So I guess the Haitian government got it secondhand. And it was the center of Haiti's financial district. In the earthquake, it first fell down and then burned up. We don't know how it burned, but it fell. And Digicel, the outside cell phone company run by Dennis O'Brien, who is from Ireland, decided that this was a good project for them to do. So built by the French, meant for the Egyptians, secondhand in Haiti, and rebuilt by an Irish cell phone company. Beautifully, may I add. But the biggest problem in the rebuilding of it was at the back of the old Iron Market was a meat selling market. And it was, shall we say, at the time, very Haitian. There was no refrigeration. Flies outnumbered humans by the usual ratio. It was very bloody. The butchers were all butchering there. It was an incredible scene. But everyone knew that if you went through the Iron Market and you got to the back, then you would get your meat. So when the Iron Market first started, there were European standards when it first started again after the renovation. And Digicel felt that they did not want to have meat being sold that was not refrigerated. It just wasn't up to European standards, understandably. So the Haitians didn't really go to the Iron Market anymore because their meat wasn't being sold there. And so all the people who sold other things, you know, it's like the aisles in a supermarket and then you get to the meat at the back. They were not selling. So it wasn't functioning well. But the last time I was there now, they have electricity on the back wall. They have refrigerators on the back wall. And the butchers are there. And now the business is beginning somewhat. But it's not the same because with refrigeration, you can't have as many people selling.
It's, to me, so indicative of this whole broader question of we tend to want to impose a certain way of doing things that aren't fundamentally Haitian.
And yet, can you say they shouldn't have refrigeration for their meat?
Exactly.
So you want them to have the refrigeration whether they want it or not. And you don't want to be – both you don't want to impose it on them, yet you don't want to be the white person who says – oh, well, they never had it before. They shouldn't have it now, especially if you're the one giving the money. You know?
And do you see any greater sense of that in the enormous relief effort that and reconstruction effort that continues of getting to a place where people understand that if you're going to provide assistance of some sort, that it has to be Haitian-driven as opposed to being imposed with European standards?
One of the worst things about the earthquake response was that it was gigantic. So once you have that much money coming in to such big organizations, it's never going to be Haitian-driven or Liberian-driven. It's going to be driven by the outsiders because they're too big. They don't know Haiti. Like if it goes to the smaller places who have been in Haiti for a long time, then that money can work in a Haitian way. But it's very, very hard for something like the UN or the International Red Cross, who only had about 13 people on the ground when the earthquake struck, to really function in any Haitian way. So they just look at problems and try to problem solve in their own way. And they don't try either to function in a Haitian way. They don't even know how to, and they're nervous.
Amy Willens is our guest. Her new book is called Farewell, Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti. We'll talk more after our break, and we welcome your calls as well if you'd like to join our conversation. If you've been to Haiti, if you have thoughts about Haiti, we'd love to hear from you as well. 866-733-6786 is our number. 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org, or you can post your thoughts on our Facebook page or on our website. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Amy Willens is our guest this hour. Her book is called Farewell, Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti. She'll also be at the World Affairs Council on Sutter Street in San Francisco today at noon. If you would like to hear more of her or if you'd like to pose a question for her, you can join us now at 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or post your thoughts or questions on our Facebook page. Let's go take a question from a caller. Elma joins us first in Foster City this morning. Elma, go ahead.
my son lives in the Dominican Republic. He's engaged to a Dominican, and I've read quite a bit and heard quite a bit about, well, two things. One, the impact of the Trujillo government on the Haitian people. I mean, when you fly over the island, you see a huge difference between what Dominican Republic looks like and what Haiti looks like. And then the other question I have is about the impact of the Catholic Church in terms of population growth and those types of things. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Elma, thanks for the call. I think in part, Elma, referring to the problem of deforestation, and you do see that demarcation between the Dominican Republic and Haiti.
Well, there are two things to be said about that. One is there is a simple element of topography. The mountains in Haiti make Haiti a semi-arid place. So Haiti, and that's where the border is. So the Dominicans have the benefit of the rainfall, and the Haitians don't have that same benefit. So Haiti has always been a more arid place than the Dominican Republic. It's always had fewer trees than the Dominican Republic. And even when the Dominican Republic was part of Haiti, that side of the island had more trees than Haiti, the Haitian side. So that's one thing. And that's a very big thing that people don't take into account. People think it's because there's something wrong with the Haitians. But there is something wrong with the Haitian economy. And that is that it has been so globally penetrated that Haiti can no longer raise its own food. And it means that a lot of farmers, which Haiti is essentially an agricultural country, can't make any money.
On that point, before we go to the other question about the Catholic Church, one of the things you describe in the book, and you do see in Haiti that's so anomalous, is for what was once a great rice-growing country, is you see bags of rice from Arkansas.
Right, right. That comes through Miami and is called Miami rice in Haiti. And it undercut Haitian rice production, which was a huge moneymaker for Haitian farmers. And what it means is if you can't make money off what you used to do in your fields, you look around and you see trees and you cut them down because you can turn them into charcoal, and that's how you enter into the cash economy and the global economy. And that's why trees come down in Haiti. People need cash to send their kids to school, to eat, and they don't have it. One, because of Miami rice. Another reason they don't have money is because in the early 80s, the United States decided that the Haitian pig had carried swine fever and conducted a huge campaign of eradication against the Haitian pig, which was like our bank account. It was a pig, you raised it, and then you could butcher it and sell it at whatever point you needed money. So they didn't have their pigs, they didn't have their rice farms, and they turned to their trees. And it's gotten worse. But this has been a problem for a long time, by the way. It's not only, you know, in the past 10 years.
And the role of the Catholic Church?
In population growth, well, of course, you know, as everywhere, they haven't been entirely positive about contraception. But still, underneath the radar, a lot of people have been going around Haiti trying to advocate for condom usage, both because of HIV and because of population control. So I think that's happening. Also, I would add that the Catholic Church suffered a really bad blow in the earthquake because their buildings, their churches were tall, very elegant things built in the 1800s, the late 1800s, and almost every one of them in the area of the earthquake fell down.
Including the cathedral.
Including the cathedral.
And the archbishop who was
The archbishop was killed, a very nice man. The bells of the churches were in the streets. I don't know what happened to them because you couldn't cart them away, but they're not there anymore.
I want to return to our question about aid. And you write at one point a really biting description of NGOs, non-governmental organizations, and you describe their approach. And here's what you write. Here's how the narrative goes. Haitians are desperate. We come down to help. They're nice people, but they're disorganized, uneducated, untrained. We give, they steal. We're upright, they lie. Despite all our best intentions, our work here is thwarted and eventually ineffective. It's sad, but there's something wrong with them. Unless we work outside the bounds of Haitian culture and the country's government and economy, we get nothing accomplished. There concludes the narrative.
Right, and that is the narrative, but that's exactly wrong. Because we come, we exclude them from the discussion about where their country should go. They refuse, they turn away, and then we blame them for being incompetent. But actually, it's our own incompetence that we see reflected in their reaction. And that has been the case with so many interactions between the Americans and the Haitians.
And you also make a kind of biting point, too, about the fact that in a way, some of these aid organizations feed off of the poor, that they need.
They must.
You write, misery in Haiti is a job creator for the white man.
Well, say you go into a Haitian earthquake camp and you can only find one young girl who's been raped. And then another organization comes in, they can find 10 young girls who've been raped. Then they can fundraise more on this situation of sexual violence in the camps than you can. So there's a kind of mad grab for victims of any kind. So they can be rape victims, or they can be the elderly, or they can be the mentally unstable. But everybody's rushing around looking to find Haitian victims. Of course, they care about these people, but they also are their fundraising tools.
Do you think people shouldn't support aid organizations?
I cannot go that far. I think we need to support the right organizations. And I think that, you know, what amazes me about this is when I started working in Haiti in the mid-1980s, already people were understanding that development had to be different, that it couldn't be imposed, that it had to be grassroots and you know, fund grassroots projects in order to work. And yet, with all that development, you know, 10A in their brains, it's still working the opposite way. So I don't know what happened. Everybody knows it has to work this way. Everybody gives lip service to the proper way of doing development. But at least after the earthquake, the reconstruction effort did not do what it needed to do.
And there are some organizations, you cite Partners in Health as one that's in, that is widely admired for taking a different approach, for
right.
really working in partnership, as its title would suggest, with Haitian-led organizations.
Right. And there are little organizations that are like that too, many, many of them. I write in my book about Dr. Megan Coffey. She's just a doctor, but she got there right after the earthquake because she had a Haitian-American friend and she had been planning to go on vacation in Haiti. Then the earthquake struck and she went then. And she started working in the general hospital in downtown Port-au-Prince, just doing triage and orthopedics, which is what you do after an earthquake, but that's not her specialty. So once the initial wave of victims subsided, she started treating TB patients, and that's her expertise. And then she developed a kind of rogue TB ward under a tent where there had been no TB ward before. In the Haitian National Hospital, incredibly.
And also would do everything from bringing in bags of spaghetti to finding places for people to go. I mean,
She was a full-service single doctor there, and she used Haitian nurses, and she learned Creole. And she's made a huge difference for her patients.
Jim in Fairfield joins us next. Jim, go ahead.
Thank you. Actually, I'm sitting outside of Barnes & Noble. I'm about to go in and to buy your book.
Oh, good.
you can really help me because I'm going to Haiti this summer. I'm doing online Creole tutorials. I'm part of a group of college biology teachers and biotechnology teachers called the Haitian Bioscience Initiative. And the idea is to go to Haiti and run courses in biology, especially microbiology, and to have a homegrown talent there that if there is another disaster, we'll know about bacteria, we'll know about water purification, we'll know about wastewater.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going there to teach biology. But everything you've said to me or said on the radio today sort of has nagged at one of my reservations. I do not want to be yet another outsider do-gooder that goes in there thinking that I'm going to, you know, impose Western-style education on them. On the other hand, I have a lot of experience in this, and it seems like a place that could help out. I really want to help out, but I don't want to, be that outsider.
Yeah,
right.
Great question, Jim.
So they need Western-style education. They are thirsting for Western-style education. I remember after the earthquake, I was sitting with a guy in the Marché Salomon. He was in a shack now after his house that he had built himself fell down in the earthquake, and his cousin was in there. His cousin had lost his wife and daughter, and his cousin was a electromagnetism student. And I was looking at his cousin's books, and it looked like something from like before Madame Curie. So they need science teachers. They need all this stuff. And it's not wrong to go down and try to do that, but it has to be organized and you have to have – Haitian contacts. Now, I would suggest the Ministry of Education, but I've heard so many bad things about the Ministry of Education, I'm not sure they're workable with, but it might be worth trying. And also find a Haitian school you can partner with that's a serious school and not a Potemkin village.
Jim, thanks for the call. You refer to, at one point, you cite an example of one NGO that was on its promotional material online or elsewhere had the slogan, come for an awesome adventure. There is this kind of sense that Jim is trying to avoid. I mean, Jim wants to provide what he can.
Right. Well, one thing I would say is that come for an awesome adventure makes you think that you're coming for 2 weeks. And that's a problem. If you really want to help the 2 week stay, I just don't believe in it. So, you know, it's more like you got to be a bit of a martyr or a saint, and you have to put your life into it. You can't just say, oh, I'll go spread some wealth for a couple of days, because that's a little bit like what the Duvaliers used to do, which was drive around and throw coins out of their car.
You write at one point that there's a disease, and Jim, thanks for the call, that people come in part also, and I'm not suggesting this is true of Jim, but I wonder about it. I wonder about it in myself and my desire to go back to Haiti, where you say people come to cleanse themselves in the stream of Haiti's misfortune. Do you think people come in part, are drawn in part, for a kind of redemption?
Absolutely. Don't you think so? I think a lot of charity is that. You feel too comfortable. You realize when you look at them on your television, oh, my God, look at how I'm living. Look at how they're living. And, you know, this whole concept of giving back, I think that there's a feeling people have, and I don't, you know, I haven't done the history and sociology to be able to say it's true, but we feel somehow that we have because they don't have. So that all of our material wealth is somehow based on the fact that the bottom billion, in which we can include Haiti, don't have that material wealth and instead have dearth, scarcity, and lack. So I think we feel by going down there, we're a little bit, we call it in Hebrew, tikkun olam. We're a little bit fixing the world and making the world more right and more just. And that's why. And then we can feel better about ourselves and go back to sitting in front of our flat screen watching the earthquake victims.
I want to ask you about that in connection to Sean Penn, because it's, you know, you could obviously think, here's the bad boy actor. He's going to go, you know, redeem himself in Haiti. You write mostly admirably about him and that he got a lot of things done, in part because he didn't act in the typical NGO way. And you use a quote of his from, I guess, a Vanity Fair article where he says, there's a strength of character in Haitian people who have, by and large, never experienced comfort. That's exactly the character that our Main Street culture lacks and needs in the United States. In other words, we need Haiti. What do you make of that feeling that we need Haiti as much as Haiti needs us? And describe that in Sean Penn.
Gee, I think we need Haiti more than Haiti needs us in certain ways. I understand what he means there. I mean, you can twist that into a kind of unfortunate statement, but I think it's about needing to understand where you are in the world. And it gives you a very clear smack in the face when you go to Haiti and you see what you have and they don't have. So you begin to understand something. Also, you see this very human strength that people identify as Haitian when they're in Haiti. But as I always like to remind everyone, it's human and it happens all over the place. And you can find it in Burma, too, of people in dire circumstances actually making their lives work and not just making their lives work, but occasionally having fun, even though they're not in comfort. So, yeah, I think we need Haiti to see ourselves from a different point of view.
Do you need Haiti?
No, well, I need Haiti. That's been my living. That's another thing that bothers me about the earthquake. It's since the earthquake, I've been writing about Haiti since the earthquake and making money off Haiti since the earthquake. I need those 300,000 dead people. I need the place to be in rubble. I've been making about an eighth of my income off it. And I feel very strongly that I must give back in some way and in a real way that I owe. You know, not just like this thing of, oh, I'm giving back by, you know, trick-or-treating for UNICEF, but really give back because they've given me so much.
What are you giving?
I'm giving a pair of arms to a little boy, I hope.
Hmm.
I hope it'll work. He's in the book, and I was feeling very bad. The book is published, and I've written all about him, and he's a little bit of a tearjerker, although my tears are very harshly jerked. You can hardly get a tear out of me, but it's very sad, the situation. He lost his hands in the earthquake, and I write about finding him and seeing him and bringing him to a hospital in Port-au-Prince and then losing track of him. But so when I went back in December after I finished the book, I actually refound him, and I've put him together with some doctors from the U.S. who come in every month or so to do prosthetic work, and they're going to do his arms. I'm very hopeful about it, but not too hopeful.
How has Haiti changed you?
That's hard to say because basically I grew up with Haiti. I mean, I started going in my late 20s. And it molded me. And I'm one of those awful people who, like, you show me a road in Jerusalem and I say, oh, that reminds me of Port-au-Prince, you know. Or you show me a Palestinian politician and I say, he's kind of like Aristide's assistant, you know. So I'm always thinking in Haitian terms and imposing Haiti on it. It's like people whose first work was in the Soviet Union when it was about to fall. And so that's the thing that's implanted in their minds, and they judge everything by whether it's too communist or not capitalist enough. But I'm kind of the opposite. I grew up in the liberation movements of Latin America as a journalist, and especially in Haiti. So that's what I impose on everything.
I'm going to play something for you, if I might. You write in the book about many, many Haitian scenes in a beautiful and captivating way. And one of the things you write about is rain. So I just want you to listen to this. That was a rainstorm when I was in Haiti last spring. What does it sound like to you?
The angry gods. You know, it reminds me of many things. Of course, it's a necessity. We love the rain because the rain brings crops and, you know, you must have it. But then it reminds me of mudslides and how the topsoil in Haiti, because of all the deforestation, is so loose that when there is a big rain, which there often is during the rainy season, that's one of the reasons I called my first book by that name, the ground comes loose and simply sweeps down over people, knocking down tents and even houses and shanties, and flows into the sea. And it also reminds me of the last night I was in Haiti in the book. When I was in that great big rainstorm and got shelter from the storm from these people who were cooking their one meal of the day.
It's the most powerful sound I think I've ever heard, and at the same time both embracing and scary.
Right. Of course,
depending on where you are.
We haven't heard.
You're under that roof. I was under a tin roof.
I was under a tent, so. But we haven't heard the sound that the earthquake made in Haiti, and that was one of the most powerful sounds.
Let's take another call. Let's go to John in San Francisco. John, go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you for this program. It makes me think that if we can't help the people in Haiti, I'm not sure we can help anybody anywhere. But my question is about President Clinton. He appears to have more or less adopted Haiti as a project, and I'd like to get your guest's assessment of his work.
John, thank you.
Well, Bill Clinton has a real affection for Haiti and has had that for a long time. In fact, I once had a single conversation with him, and he knew I was a Haiti writer. And he said, oh, yeah, Hillary and I, we went down with our friends from Citibank. I still remember that. And that was their first trip down a long time ago. So that was in the 80s that they went down, or maybe in the late 70s. So I still remember that Citibank. It shines in the back of my head as what Clinton is really about. But so he was the UN special envoy to Haiti before the earthquake, and he kind of took Haiti up as his special pet project. But it was very hard for him because he doesn't really get how Haiti works, and Haiti is intractable, seen from his point of view. And he was the co-head of the interim commission for the recovery of Haiti, that was a Haitian American sort of a front, seeming to be an umbrella group for all the little things that were going to happen in Reconstruction, but never worked and never was meaningful. He also established the Clinton Bush Haiti Fund, which he did with former President George Bush, that raised a huge amount of money and then closed its doors about 5 months ago, I believe. And you can't get to the books of that organization anymore. They're not public. You can't find out how they spent their money. But they spent a lot of Reconstruction money. It's understood. They spent a lot of Reconstruction money on projects that were actually in the pipes before the earthquake struck.
If Bill, or maybe more appropriately Hillary Clinton, were to call you up now and say, so what should we do?
You got to partner with the Haitian government. It may be icky. It may be distasteful. But we have to go through them. We have to enable the Haitian state, or we'll end up with another Duvalier eventually. You just must be in the ministries. You must be encouraging them. If they make you wait an unconscionable amount of time for your appointment, you got to deal with it. And it may be less efficient, but in the long run, it will do two things. It will make better projects. It will democratize the ministries of Haiti further, and it will strengthen the Haitian government. Mm. Without a strong Haitian government and strong Haitian institutions, no progress can really happen in Haiti.
Amy Wilentz, the book is Farewell, Fred Voodoo. As many of you know, this is a fundraising period on KQED Public Radio. To find out more about that, you can go to kqed.org. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED. Let's take another call. MJ, go ahead, please.
Yes, hi. Sorry if I feel a little flustered. Amy Wilentz is my Haiti hero. I've been reading her articles and studying her books since I was a high schooler, and she mentioned, like, this Haiti is close to her heart because she grew up with it. And the first time that I went to Haiti was when I was 14, oh. And I believe you know my mom, Randy Montreneau, and we have this small nonprofit called If Pigs Could Fly that works in a really small area in Dabon near Léogâne. And my question is related to, gosh, I have to focus on which questions, but what I found in
just
Haiti
one, if you
exactly,
would please, MJ.
Oh, yes. Okay, so about the earthquake, I went to Haiti also after the earthquake for a film project called The Soapbox in Haiti, where we talked to leaders in education and environment and women. And one of the nonprofits that we met in Jacmel was a midwives, and they said that the earthquake was an opportunity for the organizations, international aid governments, to address the centralization problem that because of it was the opposite of the rural exodus. People were leaving Port-au-Prince to go to these other areas, and instead the aid community funneled all the money into Port-au-Prince when they could have encouraged development in the rural areas for people who were already there by sending money. And I wanted to see, like, what you're saying about the misguided intentions that end up hurting people. I mean,
right.
I just...
Okay.
I
found yeah, thank you, MJ. Get,
thanks
we,
a
we
lot.
Get the gist of it. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, so... it was hard in the days right after the earthquake not to funnel money into Port-au-Prince, Léogâne, Jacmel, right? Because they were utterly destroyed and people were really suffering and relief money had to go to them. Absolutely. Now, reconstruction money has, I believe, inappropriately gone to places way far away from Port-au-Prince so that it is not really attracting people out of Port-au-Prince, which is one of the things that was desired by everyone, I think, was to, you know, relieve some of the population pressure on Port-au-Prince and not have people sitting like ducks for the next earthquake to kill them. But if you build a new factory with reconstruction money that you already were planning to build before the earthquake out in the hinterlands of the north, I don't think that the people who are still in refugee camps and earthquake camps in Port-au-Prince are going to be able to or want to go out there to get jobs. It's too far away. It's like in another country to them, in effect. But yeah, the small groups out in the countryside need support. It's absolutely true, and they need support. Big support, but on the other hand, we don't want to destroy their solidarity. So it's very confusing when you give money. I'm sure you know that, MJ. And then you see the long-range effects of where you give money.
MJ, thanks for the call. MJ mentioned documentary making, and it reminds me of this question of you know, documenting the story and giving voice to people and all of that. And I want to ask you about something you document in the book is about a suggestion box that a particular organization puts out to give voice to the homeless. And you make this very important point, I think, which is, you know, the people who are homeless aren't looking for a voice. They're looking for a home. They're looking for something much
more.
They're
looking for a job. They don't even want a home. I mean, they would like a home. That would be nice. But what they'd like is a job so they can have money, so they can build a home. They want to be self-actualized, to use an American idea. And they don't put their notes into suggestion boxes in order to become a part of a coffee table book that's used as a fundraising document for an international organization. They put their little notes into the suggestion box, and usually what they say is, my sister is sick, I don't have enough money to get medicine, we don't have enough money to get to the clinic. That's like 25 cents. And I need a job. Can you help me? And then that goes into a beautiful coffee table book illustrated with photographs from the people from the camp. And you can find that flip book under the Organization for International Migration.
And yet in the end, and I just have time for a short response here, how do you make your writing, the work that other reporters do, that I tried to do too, amount to more than that, amount to more than just giving voice?
Well, I think giving voice is really important as long as you're not making money off it. So, and I, believe me, you know, the amount of money I'm going to make off Farewell Fred Voodoo, thank you, Jim, for going to buy it, is not that much. So I feel that I can pretty purely allow Haitians to speak in my work without that overlying layer of exploitation.
Amy Wilentz, I'm glad you keep going back. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Her book is Farewell Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti. And again, she'll be at the World Affairs Council at noon today. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.